afternoon. We are going to commence today with a work session on Senate Bill 65, and then we're going to go to Senate Bill 299, but we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 65. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, the committee, you have been coming both the desk and the desk for amendments to this bill, which is great for to get my teaching. Do a whole flow of things. That's definitely to look at the amended staff measure summary that reflects the amendments. Among other things, requires that the commission grant the government no later than October 1 of each year to submit a report to the legislative fiscal office of all delinquent accounts. It also relates to benefits to judges and other things like that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the only difference between the dash 3 and the dash 4 and the dash 4 section 43, 44, and 45 under removed, that relates to security, guns in courthouses, weapons in courthouses, and we took care of that issue probably a better drafted manner in a House bill, you may remember. You took that portion out of Senate Bill 59 when it came back and put it in the House bill. My assumption is that it's probably on the way to the government right now.
That's correct.
That bill does define the weapons as this one does not, so it still has the same problem of what dangerous weapons is.
But we took care of that in the other bills, so we don't need that language in this bill. So the ones we need are the dash 3s rather than the dash 4s. The dash 4s are what we need. Okay? Questions to Ms. Taylor? If not, then the chair would move the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 65. Discussion, objection.
So, the ways and means amendment.
Right. The chair then would move Senate Bill 65 as amended. Two ways and means. Discussion, objection. Four. Thank you. Senator Courtney, good to see you.
No, it's not.
Yes, we will now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 299.
Chair, members of the committee, this is something to do with water. It allows the court in the original form to consider adjudication for some changes in use. Plaintiff diversion or preparation of place of use today. You have the dash 5 amendment before you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And the pertinent language on the amendments are in page 4, starting in line 23. The director shall have the director of the Water Resources Department shall adopt by rule a process and standards for recognizing changes in place of use, type of use, or point of diversion of water use registered pursuant to this section. I believe that's some of the things to do.
Right. And what are the changes in the dash 5 as far as the bill that we had before us earlier? On 299. He wants to stir up your pockets.
Okay.
Senator Courtney?
I'm trying to figure out what to make a motion to table this bill. And how do you cure it? No, I just got to look. I'm fine. I'm
just, all right. Senator Courtney does not move to table the bill. We have some people who want to speak on this. And what I'm going to do, I'll allow you 5 minutes to comment. In your comments, I prefer that you not address the condemnation issue, because that is something the bill is going to get into and something that the committee is not going to take up. But if you have specific issues dealing with the bill as proposed to the committee, we'll welcome those comments. And so I would invite to testify then, Mr. DePriest.
Yep. And you say? Yep.
If you could identify yourself for the record. For the record, Douglas DePriest, representing Roger and Kathy Vineyard, who are seated with me. Senator Bryant, members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. And you are being requested to validate certain existing Water Resources Department rules. And to provide authority for those rules, we urge you not to do that. We urge you to vote against the bill. One question you have to face is, should unproven water rights be easier to transfer or alter than legally established certificated water rights. One might ask, why should riparian owners who have never proved their right have an easier time moving a point of diversion, changing the nature of the use, the place of use, than a certificated right? We have not heard a reason why that should be. We have submitted a letter that should be before you. It's dated June 11. It's on buff colored paper.
Right. We received this letter, and we received also an earlier letter, and then there was a response from the Attorney General's office.
Well,
we do have that information.
Yeah, well, we have not seen a response from the Attorney General's office. We've seen a response from the department. We would be interested in seeing if there is something from
the department. I think the response was from the department. When I say the department, I'm sure the Attorney General's office reviewed it.
In looking at the department's response, it remains our position that the process that currently exists in the Water Resources Department rules with respect to alterations to the pre-1909 rights is a streamlined process that does not have all the protections that a certificated post-1909 right would have to go through. And one of those is with respect to consultation with resource agencies and the ability of Fish and Wildlife to require fish screening. That is part of the statute, not just the rule, but it's part of the statute the legislature has adopted for making similar kinds of changes on certificated post-1909 rights. That does not exist in the rules. That does not exist in the current version of the bill. In addition, there is a provision that applies to post-1909 rights that says water may be diverted or appropriated at the new point of diversion or point of appropriation only to the extent that the water is lawfully available at the point of diversion or the point of appropriation. That language is not in the current rules. It is not in the bill. Those are a couple of examples of how this bill would validate gives these earlier rights a leg up and doesn't contain the same protection. The other comment that I'd like to make is that by definition, unadjudicated pre-1909 water right claims have never had their existence, extent, or nature officially determined. It's far easier to file a claim than it is to prove a right. In essence, filing a registration statement on a pre-1909 right is akin to filing a complaint in a civil lawsuit. What does that prove? Well, it doesn't prove anything. Filing a registration statement doesn't prove anything. What it allows is the opportunity for the claimant at a later time to assemble its information, submit it, and have it evaluated. Now, in how many civil lawsuits does the plaintiff prevail? Is it 100%? Certainly not. For the portion of plaintiffs in a civil lawsuit that prevail, how many of them get 100% of what they're asking for? Every penny of damages, every bit of relief that they ask for. Well, in the typical civil lawsuit, even if a plaintiff is successful, they don't necessarily prove their full damages. So in evaluating a registration statement or claimed water rights, the mere fact of having filed the claim which allows them to prove a certain level of use, nature of use, is not equivalent and should not be confused with what the extent of the right actually is. Now, why is this important? It's important because the process that's set out here treats the right as if it exists and treats it as if it exists to the full extent of the claim. With due respect to the chairman's request, I feel it's important to mention condemnation. We have submitted an amendment, and it is the language is the last page of our materials. It is similar to the language that was submitted before the
Senate Water and Land Use Committee, but it's been simplified since the bill has undergone remarkable simplification since we last testified. And we submit that those changes would accomplish a large part of what the department says it wants, but it would not allow the taking of an existing private property right from someone who owns property, it's known, it's established, until the existence, nature, and extent of the water right, the water user's claimed right, is established. And we would say that's a matter of fairness.
Since this particular river is an unadjudicated river, I mean, that could be 20 or 30 years.
And what we are saying is that does it make sense to assume that every riparian claimant is going to be able to prove the full extent of their rights and use the powers of eminent domain and condemnation to make changes to those rights when you have an uncertainty about the existence of the right or the extent of the right? And we submit it is more fair to wait for them to be able to use the unusual power of condemnation in eminent domain until after they have proven the existence, nature, and extent of their rights.
Wouldn't you concede, though, by adopting that amendment, that effectively would not allow them to condemn for probably a period of 20 or 30 years if the adjudication started immediately?
It would depend on which basin and where it was in the adjudication process, and I would agree that adjudications are, some will be off into the future, no question. And the delay does create a problem because it's harder to prove your right if you're relying on acts that happened before 1909. We're 90 years past that now. It's going to get harder. It's going to be harder, you know, 20 years from now to prove those rights than it is now. Certainly that is. I think that's an argument for putting more money into getting the adjudications done. I don't think it's an argument for treating pre-1909 claimants in a preferred or superior category to certificated rights or to current property owners.
You don't deny, though, that the city of Springfield has a pre-1909 right view?
We don't deny that they claim that. We don't know what they'll be able to prove.
No, but your argument is the extent of their right, wouldn't it be? I mean, you don't deny that they have a water right.
But we don't know. It's never been determined.
But as a practical matter, are you saying that you would honestly contest that they don't have a pre-1909 water right?
We agree that in the late 1900s, private parties created a mill race and diverted water, and whether there has been continuous use to the extent that they can establish a right, and what the uses are that right is appropriate for, and what the volume is something a court gets to determine at the time of adjudication. And so it's difficult for me to know something I don't know.
Well, this particular bill will not adjudicate their right.
That is correct.
They'll still, at some point, if and ever the Willamette River is adjudicated, that will be something that will become an issue. What this bill would allow is for them to move their point of diversion. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Other questions for Mr. DePriest? Do you have any other comments you'd like to make?
We understand that the City of Springfield is the major primary proponent of the bill. We would submit that while the City of Springfield would like you to act on the bill, that's not a sufficient reason for you to do so. We also disagree with the City of Springfield in their contention that this diversion is the only way for them to supply water to their mill race, and believe that the city has other options. And we realize those are collateral issues to the policy issue on the
That latter one in particular, you can raise in the condemnation procedure, because you can contest whether or not they have
a public right to take this particular land. I think that most courts give short shrift to parties that claim there's not a need. I think it's very difficult to get behind a municipal body's declaration of need, and I would give somebody in that position a minuscule chance of making any headway on that.
And I will admit it's a difficult chance. I've come up with that myself, but it still allows you to raise that issue, and also you'll be able to raise this issue again on the House side if the bill passes committee and passes the floor of the Senate.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, as I said right now, what we're doing is we're dealing with the authorization for the Department of Water Resources. We're not dealing with their particular issue.
No, but
their
if you're
issue, then, yeah, I recognize. Then, as you say, the condemnation was focused. It comes to the fact that you're dealing with them. Is that correct?
This will give the department, though, the legal authority to move a point of diversion on an unadjudicated water.
Okay, and then it's going to be a court decision whether or not their situation would...
Right. The court decision will be whether or not that the city of Springfield should have the right to condemn this particular land, and if they do have the right, then the issue becomes what would be fair value to pay for it. And Mr. DeCreese's clients are entitled to fair compensation for whatever a judge or a jury determines that value would be.
And the question of fairness that we pose is, does it make sense that if, for example, the city of Springfield's right is determined to be 25 CFS, when they're now claiming 150 CFS, and they say the reason we want to build this new canal and to build a large new intake structure and take the Vineyards property and forever change the character of their property because this canal will go right through the middle of it and it would have chain link fences on both sides, should the city be given the assurance that of this departmental certification that it's okay to move the point of diversion when we don't know whether they're entitled to 10, 25 CFS or 125 or 150, but they will be building a structure that will be capable of diverting the full right. And we submit that if you waited until you knew the magnitude of the right, this issue might go away. They might not condemn at all. But if you allow them to proceed at this time before you know the extent of the right, the Vineyards property will be condemned. And while it's, yes, they have a right to appear in court and oppose it, we expect that the only meaningful issue there would be how much are they going to be paid for having this corridor taken out of the middle of their rural property and have it changed into a conduit for a municipal purpose.
Any questions for Mr. Creed?
Thank you.
We have the Dash 5 amendments before us. Martha Tegel, I believe these are your amendments, correct? Do you wish to make any comments concerning the Dash 5 or the testimony of Mr. Creed? Please come forward then. Also, Larry Campbell, do you wish to testify today? Or Senator Dwyer? Is there really? I get enough. Thank you. You're on your own.
Oh, well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Martha Tegel, Director of Water Resources Department. I just wanted to be available to answer questions and hopefully to help clarify some of the points, particularly with respect to the concern that was expressed by Mr. DePriest just now, that this bill or the rules that we have in place already regarding this subject somehow make it easier for people who hold pre-1909 rights to engage in these kinds of transfers than other users. We don't think that's the case. I have addressed that in a letter that most of you received yesterday, and we've just distributed another copy of it for your convenience. But let me just reiterate that the issue that we're talking about, authorizing or recognizing changes in pre-1909 registered uses, is something that we have had a process for as an administrative rule process since 1990. The rules that have been on the books require us to conduct an injury evaluation. the rules don't tell us exactly how to do that, but the term injury to other water rights is a phrase that is used very often in our water law statutes, and we make injury determinations in many, many different types of circumstances where we don't have specific rules, but we have a lot of experience doing injury determinations, and we basically do them the same way no matter what this type of particular application is. And the key factor here is that in making an injury evaluation, we look to see what the current use is and what the system is capable of using. So there's a built-in check there that we wouldn't allow an enlargement of the rights in the transfer process, because we'd first be looking to see whether in proceeding with this transfer, they would be trying to take more water than they are currently able to take and currently are taking. So the injury determination, even though the rules that we have in place don't specify step-by-step how you do that, it is something that we have a long history of agency experience with. The second point that I would make is that it's just kind of a shame from our department's point of view that this broader legal issue that is being addressed by the bill is getting kind of tangled up with the particular circumstances of this case and this condemnation, because the generic issue here of the people who hold pre-1909 registrations is one that is of significance to a whole lot of people in the state, and even though it would probably be in the long run a more satisfactory cure for us to proceed with these adjudications, the fact of the matter is we are not going to be able to do that. They are very expensive and time-consuming. We would need much greater staffing levels than we have now and millions of dollars in our budget to be able to do that. So the fact of the matter is that these people are going to have to wait. And there are other projects in the state where these kinds of transfers are going to become important. I was just in a meeting yesterday with folks from PGE on the plans that they have on the Sandy and Little Sandy River. That can be affected by this same issue. So we do think that the safeguards are there. As I mentioned in my letter, in addition to the injury determination, we also have an additional test of no change in the net amount of water that's available to other users. That's yet another double check to make sure we're not enlarging the right or increasing the amount of water diverted. With that, maybe I'll take a breath and see if you have questions for me.
Questions for this paper?
Mr. Chairman, there was some discussion about the pre-1909 water rights. They're unadjudicated. Do they have any special status? Or?
Well, almost all the rivers west of the mountains are unadjudicated, and we're trying to adjudicate the Klamath Basin, and that's been going on for how many years?
About 10 years.
Yeah. 10 years. Probably have another 10 years.
What's the magic of the 1909 date?
Well, that's when we passed the Oregon Water Law dealing with future water rights and how they would be adjudicated. And there was a recognition that there were water rights prior to that time, which the users file a certificate indicating their claim of use, what their use is, how it's put to the beneficiary's property. And to some extent, it has some regulation with the department now, even though it's pre-1909. For instance, if you change the use or you don't use it, you can be subject to losing it. But the Deschutes Basin went through an adjudication, I think, in the 50s or the 60s, and it took a long time. Finally, it's a court order that determines what the water rights are and where they're adjudicated. But it will be, my guess, is 100 years before they finish the adjudication on the rivers on the west side. Other questions? Thank you for testimony. We are in your session. Are there questions or discussions? The chair then will move the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 299. Discussion? Objections? Favors? The chair then will move Senate Bill 299 as amended before due pass. Senator Tarnow. Please indicate Senator Tarnow is a no.
As you were shifting comments.
Oh, yes.
This is a very, very difficult vote because you get involved with personalities and things. I have not had a chance to visit with the vineyards, but members of my staff did.
and present a good case when you look at their individual situation. And I've tried to analyze it, and I guess I'm going to, I will be voting aye. It's an uncomfortable aye, because I understand if I were in their shoes, how I would feel. And but I guess that, looking at the big picture of the whole thing, I'm going to be supportive of it, but very uncomfortably, because of a particular problem you folks face, and I understand your concern, and we could help you someplace along the line, but I guess that's going to be battled out in some other agreement. But I did appreciate the fact they spent some time with my staff. And
they spent some time with Maureen, too.
Convinced my staff.
Motion carries, and Senator Beyer. We'll assign him that. He will be the one carrying that bill. Doesn't matter that he left the room, we're still going to sign it for him. We'll now go to a work session on Senate Bill 723. This deals with the PERS board and a different composition to it. It's a dashed one amendment. So, Taylor, what are these two?
What are the draft law amendments to? Modify membership of the revenue members first with the six public members and opposed to three now. Two members shall be engaged with citizen public service. One member shall be free for
And these are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, is that correct? As they currently are, I believe. This is Ann's bill. Okay, this is Ann's bill, so Mr. Daly's substituting here.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
For me, it doesn't matter who the legal counsel is. It's still a bad bill. I guess my frustration is that my recollection is it's not a bad bill. My recollection is that we changed the PERS board last biennium, last session, and it's like, when is enough enough? It's like, the last session was enough as far as I was concerned. Why would you know?
I believe we added two public members last session, or it might have been 95, I'm not sure which one, but we did add some public members that weren't there before. Senator Cordy.
As I said, I think 4 years ago, when we were discussing this upstairs, best of my knowledge, there was no evidence given by any witness that appeared extensively on this whole issue going back to 72 that could point out what was wrong with the makeup of the present board. Nobody said that. There's no testimony, written, verbally or otherwise. And so I don't understand why we're doing this. There was no justification given. There was no problem. There was no negligence, incompetence, anything. Lack of input. So again, I said then, I'll say now. I see no reason we're doing this.
You should have in your file a memo from Maria Keltner at the Association Board in County, dealing with reasons why the association rather felt that changes would be appropriate. And no one accuses the existing board of acting in bad faith. I think the proposal is generated because that by having the different board members where you wouldn't necessarily be controlled by members who are beneficiaries under the plan, that in the areas that, for instance, she lists in her single-page memorandum, you might get a different balance, a different decision. But clearly, the new board members, if this were adopted, still have to comply with the statute, comply with the fiduciary obligations created by the statute and the IRS trust regulation.
And
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, that requirement is that the retirement system is for the benefit of the retirees.
That's true, and it will remain that way. The chair then would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 723. Is there a further discussion? We have objection from Senator Brown and Senator Courtney. Please indicate them with no. Is there any other objection? Hearing none, motion passes, and Senator Gerfler will carry.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I forgot to move the bill.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I'm sorry. The amendment passes. The chair then would move Senate Bill 723 as amended to the floor if it do pass recommendation.
Ellen Jan object. And serve notice of such a possible minority report.
Please indicate Senator Brown, Senator Courtney objecting and serving notice of possible minority report. Other objections?
Mr. Chair, I will vote to send to the floor, but reserve the right to possibly vote no on the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Duncan. Motion carries. Senator Durr, for the report. Okay. Let's now go back to House Bill 2436. I mean, we heard this some time ago, and at that time I had some concerns, I think others did too, about what the impact this would have on the state hospital. This is the bill that would require someone to go to the state hospital within 72 hours after court determined they are not able to aid or assist in their trial. And the concern was, does the state hospital have the facilities to take these people, and if they don't, what happens? Because you don't want to force people out of the state hospital who are already there. And their answer was that currently, because we opened up a new wing, they have room. But I was still concerned about the impact. And
A8 amendment, Mr. Chair, which put a 2-year sunset on the bill. You'll notice that they're quite thick, because what we do now on amendment, the sunset provision,
I don't have the A8. We'll put this one on hold for a sec. Thank you.
That sunset provision is for how long, please?
2 years, Mr. Chairman.
That's just to say, we look at it in the same state of the region.
Right, because in your amendment, the testimony of the fiscal impact table shows that indeterminate fiscal impact now because they have the room, but they're not sure what will happen over the next several years. So she gets an opportunity to come back 2 years from now and see what the impact is going to
be. In terms of whether or not they hold it.
Whether it's filled up with capacity for this or for other means.
The other problem with it is it's a cost shift, because counties then could say, well, where they might have the responsibility for holding these people, whether or not they have the facility or not, say, send it to the state hospital.
You realize what you say. You realize what you say, is it a possibility or it is a cost shift?
It's a possibility.
I think it's a cost shift.
I think it would be too.
Wouldn't you say that counties are subsidizing the state now, and that the only way we're going to get a 2 cents of the actual cost is for our surveillance for a period of time?
Maybe. What do counties do now when they determine someone's unable to aid and assist in their defense in a criminal matter? They have to hold them somewhere. Where do they... Girl, what you're hearing?
All the contracting out to local hospitals who have the capability to hold medical patients in secure wards.
And at some point, if they don't approve, of course, they come to the state system. But generally, how long are those holds usually? How long do they take them?
36 weeks.
70. Fairly short period of time?
Yes.
Well, if that's true, then this probably isn't much of a change.
They have to go here, right?
Right.
And the fact that the county wouldn't have the money or the cover, that's irrelevant. Because I'm just saying, I think it raised the issue. I think it's just clearly it's going to, in some ways, there will be a caution.
I didn't make a copy. All right.
Did everybody get it?
No, they're making copies. We'll close the temporarily the public hearing on the sewer district, and then we'll take a look at it. All right. Let us go to House Bill 731.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you have the -10 amendments, 8-10 amendments, 10 amendments before 8-10, prohibit specified person from stenographically recording deposition in civil action, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully you have the intent, right?
Mm-hmm. That
happens. Hey, Tim. Okay.
Yeah, I'm moving down there, Joe. Oh, okay, thank you. The party together on this.
Still okay, we do not have a group.
Whose amendment is this?
This is an amendment from Carl Myers. And related, I think, to my question concerning what they meant by equal charges. I didn't think that was well written on subparagraph B of section 2.
I'm trying to put this all together, but is there, it's been brought to attention that there's some concern about it, but really this is exceeding competition and sort of price fixing kind of a thing. Do you see that in this in the A10? The Dash 10 amendments?
Well, the Dash 10 don't really necessarily address that particular issue. In testimony in opposition to the bill, right, Paul Romaine brought out that this would limit competition. The A10s, and Carl, why don't you come forward?
Mr. Chair, it seems appropriate that Paul come forward
right
as well.
Yeah.
I guess my few was a comment. If we could get the opponents and the proponents of justice unity together, it seems to me we should be able to work something out here that both sides can agree with on this bill. Just a comment.
That would please me.
And maybe we can't, but this seems like we could do that.
Well, let's begin with an explanation of the A10s. As I understand it, and my memory is foggy, this was to include replacement language for equal charges to conform to what is currently in some sort of a rule or code, correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. That's correct. During the last hearing, you, Mr. Chair, had some concerns about the language on page 2, line 2, making equal charges to all parties for the cost of the record and report. And we had at that time copies of the CSR, the Certified Shorthand Reporter Rules, out of the Supreme Court. And it was your comment that you thought those were more explanatory. I need to clarify, those are not my amendments. Those were the amendments to address your question that Ms. Tweed asked me to submit to Legislative Council since she was leaving and was not going to be here to submit them. So those were submitted to address your question, and I thought, Mr. Chair, conformed with what you how you thought the bill should read in that regard.
I do think it clears up the language on page 2, line 2. So that answers my concern on that, and I think that's an improvement also by saying and attorneys in the proceeding. That also clarifies my question that came up on line 26 of page 1. So any questions on the dash A10? All right. Now to Senator Brown's question. The point of contention. The remaining point of contention. And I'm looking at Mr. Romaine's memo dated June 11th. And Carl, do you have a copy of that?
I do not.
Paul, do you have an extra copy that you can share?
I just have my one copy of it. I could explain it in a nutshell, if
all right.
You wish. The question, this is Paul Romaine, and the question really comes down to in this bill, pricing. It's really a dollar question. And the difference between what Carl wants to do and what we would like to do is we view each deposition as a separate thing within a case, and Carl views the case as a whole. Carl's amendment basically says that once a court reporter takes a deposition in the case, they are in effect locked in for that fee for every deposition in that case from then on out, no matter who requests the deposition. Now, our objection to that are that court reporters are not essential. A particular court reporter is not essential to a particular case. Court reporters, while highly skilled, are fungible. In other words, you could have one attorney that likes a court reporter or doesn't like a court reporter, they can bring their own. If you don't like the personality or the fee that a court reporter is charging, then you can get another court reporter. There is nothing that stops you or says that you have to use a particular court reporter. In addition, in a case, you run in, if you adopt Mr. Meyer's amendment, what you run into is what happens if a court reporter is under contract, say, to take a particular deposition and refuses to take the deposition for anybody else noticing a deposition, which they can do. Right now, you can't compel them to take a deposition. There's hundreds of court reporters in the state. Why are you now compelling them to charge everybody the same fee? We can understand possibly disclosing fees. We have nothing wrong with any disclosure or anything like that. But for the life of us, we can't figure out why you would want to, in effect, mandate the same fee all the way through, especially since this is not something that everybody has to use. There's a lot of court reporters around. That's our problem with the bill. We've pretty much accepted everything else in the bill. So it's really, Mr. Chair, that paragraph C of Mr. Meyer's amendment, which we have the most problem with. We don't have a problem with disclosing.
You wouldn't have a problem if they had to give the same rates for the same series of depositions. And what I'm thinking of here, and we're probably to a timing issue, but if you have a week of depositions and you begin with the plaintiff's witnesses and you conclude with the defendant, Mr. Meyer said, well, those rates shouldn't be changed during that time frame. Your objection, I think, would have more relevance if it were 6 months or a year down the road, and the case is still going on, and there's another set of depositions, and the court reporter has changed their rates during that time frame, not in an effort to show favoritism to anyone, but just changed the rate.
Mr. Chair, obviously we would be more satisfied with that kind of language than what Mr. Meyer has here, but let me give you another scenario. What happens if I'm the plaintiff and you're the defendant, and I bring my court reporter for my depositions that I notice, and you want your court reporter for your depositions that you notice? They charge different fees. They're within the same time frame. We've agreed that we're all going to come to Bend, and on Tuesday we're going to take my depositions, and on Wednesday your deposition. Each court reporter can charge a different fee. We may negotiate. You and I may ask the court reporter, which we can, to charge us the same fee, and they probably will. But why would you want to legislate that?
I think the issue they're trying to get at is favoritism. And I see it as I don't know why, when I heard you speak, what I saw is, I see it as a different thing as having everybody goes out and hires their own court reporter and pays whatever they want them to pay. If the court reporter doesn't want to charge anything, fine. But when there's one court reporter that people are using, and he or she charges one party differently than the other party, it feels like there's favoritism. So do you have another way of addressing the favoritism issue? And do you think disclosure does that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, no, it is favoritism. That's the whole purpose behind contracting. It's basically what you do. It's a way to... I'm not trying to hide anything from you. I mean, you're favoring people with a particular fee. It's the same way that if I do alcoholic beverage control work and you come to me and I may favor one client versus another client, there is a form of favoritism. There's nothing to stop you from negotiating ahead of time to get the same rate. And most court reporters, I know the one that we work with, would be glad to give the same rate once, you know, it's disclosed. We have no problem. Disclosure, we believe, would solve that problem. If they had to disclose and, you know, we found out if disclosure actually might be good for us. Because if the other parties found out that there was a cheaper rate, hey, they might hire us. So we're all in favor of disclosure. That's great. I'm not sure the other court reporters would like that, but disclosure would be great.
Well, Carl, it goes back into a question I think I asked earlier. If, as I said, I have no problem with fee, you know, as long as this depositions are taken within a time frame of you know, reasonable, all related to the same case. But if 6 months or a year passes, then court reporter, I think, should be able to change the rate somewhat.
Hi, Mr. Chair, let me, and members of the committee, let me address that one issue. The discovery, even though the case may be years old, the discovery process generally is not very long. So we're not talking about years and years and years. Second of all, the cost to a court reporter essentially don't increase much over time. As a matter of fact, they sort of decrease with competition. Thirdly, a court reporter who is asked a year later to do a deposition on the same case that they had done earlier has the right to refuse that if their rates have gone up or their costs have gone up such that the cost that they originally did the deposition for would be prohibitive. So they're not binding a court reporter to do anything. They can always refuse the job. The last thing I would tell you is those attorneys that are working the case signed up on a retainer agreement at whatever hourly fee that was, and that goes throughout the whole case as well, unless there is a written agreement amongst the client and attorney to increase that rate or whatever. So I am not concerned that 6 months is going to be harmful. And this is an issue that all Oregon court reporters think is important. The same rate, and we're talking about a rate, essentially a fee schedule. We're not saying that they have to charge the same rate for copies as transcripts. We're saying that there can be a fee for copies, a fee for transcripts, a fee for expedited copies or transcripts, as well as a separate fee for extraordinary work, travel, et cetera, so it is a fee schedule that will be disclosed and stuck to, not fees, and they need to treat them the same.
Mr. Chair, if I might just respond quickly, never letting an opportunity go by. When we say all court reporters in Oregon, I think we're a little misspoken here. The group is not, it represents a portion of the court reporters, and I can't give you the exact percentage, but I know my client contracts with, they do not represent 90% of court reporters in this state. I will venture to guess, just because of folks that I have, other court reporters have been calling me on this thing. It is imperative, I believe, in a free market system to have total disclosure. I agree with Senator Brown on that. But why in the world you would fix the rates? You know, we can go along with a situation where you do it for a reasonable period of time, you know, the day of the deposition or week or whatever, or during those times they schedule. But if you can't compel them to take the deposition, why are you going to compel them to charge a particular fee?
Mr. Chair, in response, again, let me add that the CSR rules are in place. There are almost 200 CSRs out of approximately 277 court reporters in the state so that, that are already subject to language just as we see here in the A-10. I would ask that the A-10s be moved.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. And now you see why we were successful on physician-assisted suicide with groups of 8 or 9, but not in this particular case. What I would like to do, and committee, tell me what you, if you would go along with this, at 8, what I, at the conclusion of 8, after it says throughout the proceeding, I'll say for a period of 180 days from the date of the first deposition. How does that sound? All right, the chair conceptually then would move to amend the dash A-10 amendments to read on line 8, deleting the period and saying for a period of 180 days from the date of the first deposition, period, end quote. And is there a discussion, objection, supported? The chair then would move the dash A-10 amendments to House Bill 2731. Discussion? Objection. Order. The chair then would move House Bill 2731 to the floor with a due path recommendation. Discussion. Objection. So order. The following. And who'd like to carry this? Probably
nobody.
The chair will carry. Oh, Senator Courtney will carry. Thank you. All right. I want to congratulate Senator Tarno on being appointed the Rules Committee. My set, and I want to thank him for accepting that.
They're already through.
They're through?
They're through for the day, yes.
Oh, well, I'm no longer in the role. So, you and Senator
Courtney.
You
didn't get there on time, so.
Great. Go for it, sir.
Did they do anything?
You might
have
got it.
Yeah.
All right, let's then go to the work session again on Senate Bill 2436. We have the date dash A-8 amendment in front of us, and this is the one we were discussing earlier. And we put a 2-year sunset on it, and that's why the length of these particular amendments.
What bill?
This is on 2436, dealing with the 72-hour transfer.
Okay.
I guess one of the questions someone raised was maybe making this a may rather than a shall for the counties in the event that for some reason the counties wanted to hold the person. I have to go back to the basic bill. Mr. Horton, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm pensioning right now for Bill Taylor, who has to go to another committee.
Yeah. Didn't have to change all of that stuff, so it looks like. Well, we'd have to rewrite the section. Because this is a mandate that the court shall commit the defendant. Well, let's say that there might be some temporary reason why the person is unable to assist. And they might say, I'd like to hold this person for a little while longer. Maybe it's because they get another examination. And why they have to transport them from Coquille or Coos Bay up to Salem and then bring them back for an examination or a court appearance 2 days later.
Yes. Tough call.
I'd like to still give the court that flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not do it today.
Yeah.
And so we'll close the public hearing. Just John, the issue on that, too, is under the existing statute, which I'm not familiar with, an antique problem yet. What flexibility there is now.
I can discuss that if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
We can do that at a later date. Mr. Chairman, my understanding of the way that it works both in statute and in practice is that what is supposed to happen is that the court, basically immediately upon making a determination that the defendant cannot aid and assist, is supposed to commit the person to the state mental hospital. The problem that I think the bill sought to address was that the defendant was really languishing for a long period of time in the county jail, and it was really not healthy for the defendant, and it wasn't what was supposed to happen. So I, it seems that what the current law does is to make the commitment to the state hospital a shall rather than a may. And that would be a policy call on the part of the committee as to whether or not that should become a may. But it would be a change from what currently does happen.
But right now, a judge could send him to the state hospital if they wanted to. They have that flexibility, or do they need the authority in statute to do that?
The authority already is in statute. In fact, the judge has to do that. It's really more a matter of state hospital maybe not having the room, as I recall the testimony on the House side. And so it's simply been more of a, if I may, sort of almost a bureaucratic problem where the defendant is staying longer than the court intends the defendant to stay in the county system. Even if the court orders that the defendant go, it just doesn't happen much of the time.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure I'm willing to oppose the show, but we'll think about that before we schedule it again. We'll open a work, a public hearing on House Bill 3158 and Representative Backlund. And if you'd like to bring someone with you, feel free to do that. By the way, we had heated debate on the floor of the Senate when the senator from Lake Oswego congratulated his baseball team. There was righteous indignation from the senator from the McNary district about the playoff game. And, of course, you've had great success in the past there. It might have been just the coaching change, Peter. But what was interesting to me was the catcher for McNary to give Gilmore's son.
That's right.
And, of course, Gibb is a North Salem Viking, all state in three sports, and I was a year behind him in North Salem, and remember him well. So it sounds like his son's a pretty good catcher.
Senator Bryan, I would like to commend the good Senator Courtney from our district because he is a fine fan, and Mary High School is in his district. And Senator Courtney and I have been big buddies since I discovered that we're both Boston Red Sox fans. So that's very, very important.
Oh, I didn't know that of you. Indeed. I thought you were a Dodger fan. You were in the Dodger organization.
In the Dodger organization, but I grew up as a Red Sox fan.
Sure.
Yes,
sir. Does McNary High School hire athletics now?
To my knowledge, Senator Duncan, they're doing quite well.
Yeah.
Sir Bryant, members of the committee, I am Vic Backlund. I am a representative from District 33, which is North Salem and Kaiser, which does include North Salem High School and McNary High School.
I have a question. Recently we heard a report from a local senator who was unruly in one of his son's ball games.
You wouldn't know anything about it.
Have you ever seen Senator Courtney in the stands react in an emotional way?
Sheriff Bryant, to be succinct, yes.
Well, I understand he's going to behavior modification school, so we'll see if
it won't do any good.
Good afternoon. Tell us about 3158.
It is my pleasure to be here, and I might add that House Bill 3158 did come out of the House on a 58-0 vote. And we're hoping to have some similar results in the Senate side. The bill came to me early in the session after a conversation with McNary High School's vice principal, and he pointed out to me that the school has a problem. The problem I'm referring to is a situation in which a student who is under the supervision of a parole officer leaves one school district and moves to another one within the state of Oregon, and there's no notification to the new school district of this particular student's background. So at McNary High School, for example, there have been numerous instances where such students transfer into our school or into our district and administrators and the counselors and the teaching staff have no knowledge of this young man or young woman's probationary status. It makes it very difficult for those people to schedule this kid into the proper classes, and a lack of information here about this probationary student can be a real problem. So currently we discovered that Oregon statutes do not provide for the communication of a student's parole status as he or she moves from one school district to another in Oregon. So this bill addresses the problem by requiring parole officers to notify school districts within 72 hours of their becoming aware of the student's change of address. The thing that we wanted to do was to make sure there was a timely information flow when a probationary student actually transferred, and we think that House Bill 3158 might be very helpful. So thank you.
And we have some -4 amendments. And if you had a chance to review those, and are those your amendments?
I think earlier, Senator Bryant, I think earlier our amendments were -2.
-2s are here also.
Yeah, I think those we brought to you.
I have a -.
And we do. I see some -4s.
Yeah, they might be just conflict amendments. They are conflict.
I think that's correct.
To handle what was done in Senate Bill 449, which partially addressed this issue. Are there questions for Representative Backlund? If not, we'll close the work set. Excuse me, the public hearing of the work session on House Bill 3158. Senator Cordy.
-4 members to House Bill 3158.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves the -A4 amendments to House Bill 3158. Discussion. Objection for
House Bill 3158 is amended to the floor with the affairs recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved that the bill as amended go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection for thank you. Carried. Thank you. Senator Courtney is carried. Next, we'll have a public hearing on 2807 and invite Kent Stricker, also representing Lewis. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair of Committee. For the record, I'm Leslie Lewis. I'm the state representative for District 29. What I bring to you today is a bill that arose out of a very sad circumstance in Yamhill County. We had a young lady, a 12-year-old, Lacey Robanto, who was sexually assaulted and brutally murdered about a year ago. And it was learned that the individual did have a prior sex offense, but predated 1989, and he was not on a registration list. And the community came together and asked Senator George and I to bring forward legislation dealing with Lacey Robanto's murder. And we do have two pieces of legislation. One is still down in Ways and Means. This is one of those two pieces, House Bill 2807, which deals with notification. Our community felt that there was not good enough notification to the community when individuals who have are deemed to be predatory sex offenders are living in the community. And this bill was worked on by the House Judiciary Committee. It's not in the form that it came to them in, but I think they struck a reasonable compromise between the parole and probation officers, the state police, and also addressed some of the concerns of our community. And what they came up with in House Bill 2807 is that when a person is deemed to be a predatory sex offender, the agency that is supervising that person shall send the notice to the state police of the person's status and enter the person into the law enforcement data system that the person is a predatory sex offender and send the information which is listed in subsection
licensee. On subsection 3 of this section, which is the list about the person's name and address, the physical description, type of vehicle, all of that information to the state police. And then the state police can make that information available to the public. And we saw this as a companion bill to a bill that you worked on months ago, it seems like now, Senate Bill 740, which will make that information available to the public by electronic access. And we think the two bills combined will go a long way towards meeting the needs of our community and addressing their needs about needing to be notified when predatory sex offenders are in the community. And we see those two bills as working together in companion.
Chair Brandt, committee members, for the record, my name is Kent Zwicker. I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police. I supervise the sex offender registration unit. I think Representative Lewis pretty well summed it up, but what I've included, which may help clarify a little bit, Senate Bill 740, there's a piece in there that would permit us to make the sex offender information available to the public. And that's both in person by inquiry or available through internet access. What would be the third page of the submitted testimony is a graphic chart that shows in the center of the central repository database. Of our total population of sex offenders, both supervised and unsupervised, somewhere around estimates between 7 and 15% of those are predatory offenders. Under Senate Bill 740, we would not be permitted to release through the Internet, for example, information about predatory supervised sex offenders. So 2807 is critical in bridging that gap and making that information also available to the public.
Questions from the witnesses concerning this bill? Hearing none, thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open the work session then on House Bill 2807.
We can go through our conflict amendments with Senate Bill 740.
So we do need the dash 3.
Need the dash 3 amendments.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves the dash 83 amendments to Senate Bill 2807. Discussion? Objection to order.
Move the bill. Order the discussion amendment is amended.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2807 as amended and the floor do pass. Discussion? Objection? So order. I see Senator George is on this bill. Leslie, do you know, would he like to carry it? Thank you. We will allow him to do that.
We have another public testimony to be part of that discussion.
And,
no, I know that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm checking this to see if there's any other public testimony today before we go to the work session on the rest of the bill. Which one is that? Okay. Let's go back. We will then go on House Bill, open work session on House Bill 2731. And yeah, we covered this one. We did this. Excuse me. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3376, which deals with trespass, and I believe we have some amendments on that.
I'll move the A2 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Duncan moves the A2 amendment to House Bill 3376. Discussion? Objections from order?
I'll move 3376 as amended to the floor. Would it be passed for consideration?
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 3376 as amended to the floor. Be passed. Discussion? Objection? Motion carried. Senator Duncan, would you carry that bill?
Sure.
And we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill, excuse me, a work session on House Bill 3084. And I think we have dash A4 amendments on this that have not been adopted. Yeah. Is that correct, Jim?
I believe that is second.
The amendments exclude domestic violence sentencing programs from the conditional discharge plea. This is a memo from Representative Patridge.
Is this Patridge in the pear tree?
This is Patridge in the pear tree? That's right. My wife wrote that for 7 days ago.
That was very impressive.
The 7 days of signing down.
12
hours as well.
She is very
isn't she though?
She really is. I've seen other works.
You think it's because of our relationship?
No.
Fight up.
The chair would move the dash A4 amendment to House Bill 3084. Discussion, objections, ordered. The chair then would move House Bill 3084 to 40 pass. Discussion, objections. Ordered. Carrier. All carry.
Oh, I'm happy to carry it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
I'm sitting here during the testimony, so.
Good. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2096. And this deals with licensing agencies petitioning to disclose police investigation reports. And we have some dash A4 amendments. And a hand and growth bill. Are there questions or concerns about the bill or the dash A4? Oh, Ingrid. Teacher standard practice. Did you want to make some comments on this bill?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. In the criminal offense, I had not seen the dash fours, and I don't know what their content is, so I'd ask counsel if we could review them.
Oh, I have the dash fours. We'll postpone the public, work session for a moment, and we'll let you review the dash A4s. But does the rest of the committee have the dash A4s?
Mm-hmm.
So, Ingrid, why don't you take my copy? Would anyone else like a copy of the dash A4s? We'll come back to that in a moment. We'll now go to House Bill 3051. And we had a public hearing on this earlier. I don't think anyone else has signed up to testify. Is that correct? On House Bill 3051. If not, then we'll close the public hearing and go into work session on House Bill 3051. John, are there any amendments to this bill?
There are, Mr. Chairman. There are a couple of different alternatives. The A2 committee agrees to report the committee. The committee would not be able to adopt both of those because they conflict with each other. And the A2s, I believe, were presented by Ingrid Swenson. And then the A3s, I believe, are presented by Kevin Campbell and Dale Kim. And I can explain what you like, or I know that there was some explanation yesterday as well.
You know, and I think the memory, unless we need additional explanation, I think the testimony is pretty clear from yesterday. Senator Tarno, did you have questions?
I'm not from the A3s.
The A3s, and I was going to suggest one change there on line 8, where it says who received the copy. I would say who requests the copy. So, Senator Tarno moves a conceptual amendment on the A3s on line 8, where the word received would be replaced with the word request. Is there objection? Hearing that, the order then. Senator Tarno moves the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3051. Discussion? Objection? Order. Those are as amended by the conceptual amendment. So
Senator Tarno then moves House Bill 3051 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Tarno will carry. We'll now open a work session on 2396. Right. Do you have that corrected today?
Not yet, Mr. Chairman, and I can summarize a concession, a proposal that may take care of the problem if you'd like.
Right. This is one where on page 2 we changed it from shall to may, but we need to go back and reconsider this because on is an aggravated murder case that won't work?
Correct. Well, correct.
So why don't you describe what the fix would need to be.
One potential fix would be to eliminate the bold language on lines 14 and 15 of page 2 and simply add at the end of line 15 or a mandatory minimum sentence under ORS 161-610 may be imposed. What that would do is prevent any change to the aggravated murder sentencing statute but allow the judge to have discretion with the mandatory firearms minimum.
So that would accomplish this, what we were trying to do with the conceptual amendment, with the exception of excluding the aggravated murder portion.
Correct.
The chair would move that conceptual amendment as outlined by Mr. Horton. Okay. Could you just say 1 second while I move this one? Is there objection to that conceptual amendment? Hearing is ordered. The chair then would move House Bill 2396 as amended by the conceptual amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? D? Okay, thanks. Is there a carrier for that bill?
Okay.
Thank you. And for the record, I meant to mention this on 3051, we have a letter from Peter Glazier, Department of Transportation. So you should add that to the record, Jonathan.
A little bit.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You always show up.
Oh, my gosh.
It's Kayla. She's up in Tampa today.
I see. How old are you, Kayla?
4.5.
Well, my grandson's 4.5, and he comes to committee once in a while, too.
CJ.
Do you have a nickname for your grandpa?
Vern.
Vern. That's a good nickname. Well, welcome, Kayla, and you come back to see us again. Is this your daughter behind you?
Yes, this is Annette. Yeah.
Oh, welcome. All right. Well, also welcome.
Thank you.
I put that in the record, too.
I do want to insert this in. Our committee members are not here today.
This is from the party.
Thank you,
I lost my quorum. Is Senator Brown out in the hallway? We're almost done. House Bill 3047, we weren't here today because we don't have the amendments. Ingrid, have you had a chance to feel comfortable with the dash A4s?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the chance to review them. They don't affect the pieces of the measure which concerned us, about which we have testified. We oppose the bill, and we continue to oppose it with or without the amendments.
I don't have a quorum this morning. Okay, good.
We did that.
Between 2462. Oh, there's some garnish, wasn't it, on a side dish?
Interesting. And Peter made it for it.
Well, it's pretty helpful that I started working for the committee after the party.
That's right. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, I started a couple days before.
Ah, there you go.
And I got it on the party.
He knew when to join.
That's right.
What?
You knew when to join.
Yeah.
Dale, we have on 2960 A4s and the A5s. I don't know if fingers have seen the A5. On 2096. It came from the Department of Justice. I was just curious. I imagine their phone is ringing. All right. Why don't we, committee, it's 3:30. It's Friday afternoon. We're going to reschedule these on Monday. Why don't we adjourn?
Good idea.
And I must, it is a Friday and my mind is foggy. I know some of the things just happened yesterday, but it seems like a week ago.
Have you seen that? No, I have not. I have one. What have you got? You think that's